And, you know, so the need for the catchiness of the heroic couplet, I think, comes to a nation just recovering from an enormous trauma, from division, really concerned with healing itself, with trying to bring things together. And the bonds, the binding process that it needed was one that was, you know, sort of much more, I suppose, you know, sort of much more, you know, kind of obvious and simple. Milton in Paradise Lost, I think, is, you know, sort of one of the reasons that he's rejecting that is precisely because it does represent an understanding of the Civil War, what happened during the Civil War, and what the country should do next, completely antithetical to everything that he believes in. Now, that said, however, just the last thing maybe we can end on is that it looks, therefore, that, you know, sort of Milton has to reject rhyme in the 1660s because rhyme upholds an ideology of, you know, sort of a politics that he had been fighting against his entire life. However, his last published work, Samson Agonistes, does use quite a bit of rhyme. And maybe this is where we can just end. If Pascal, if you could give me, you see, I think it's number B11 here. It's, you know, this is a closet drama. You can find out more about it if you come on November 30th to the Arts Council Room at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. We'll be doing a reading of it. It's a great poem. And it's a bit like Lycidas in that, you know, it has rhyme, it sometimes doesn't have rhyme, the rhyme is kind of unpredictable. But at the very end, it settles into a rhyme. And lo and behold, how many lines are there? Guess? Well, you should. 14! It's 14. It's 14 lines. So we have another kind of submerged, you know, sort of ghost of a sonnet here, or a potential, you know, sort of sonnet here. And so I guess, you know, sort of this poem, this work has often, you know, sort of fascinated people because published the way it was as Milton's last newly written work of poetry, it's often taken as Milton's last word, which I think is a little bit dubious. But if we want to think a little bit about that, you know, sort of the last words in the play are again reinstating a rhyme scheme. So how, I mean, it's hard because I know most of you haven't read Samson Agonistes, but you know, the story of Samson, you know, sort of from the Bible, it basically tells his temptation by Delilah, his fall, but his ultimate regeneration or recovery of his strength, in which he basically, you know, pulls down the pillars and killing a lot of Philistines. And it ends with the chorus and his father basically saying that this is a good thing, that Samson has been able to achieve what he wanted. And so the poem does end with a possibility, at any rate, of closure. This is the chorus. I'll just read it out loud. All is best, though oft we oft doubt what the unsearchable dispose of highest wisdom brings about, and ever best found in the close. Oft he seems to hide his face, but unexpectedly returns, and to his faithful champion hath in place bore witness gloriously, whence Gaza mourns and all that band them to resist his uncontrollable intent. His servants he with new acquist of true experience from this great event with peace and consolation hath dismissed, and calm of mind, all passion spent. Now here's an interesting, because Milton is very much drawing on the language of catharsis here, the sense that what we've witnessed has been, because it's a tragedy, a kind of cathartic experience. And it brings the poem to a close, and I think it raises interesting questions, you know, again about closure, and the kind of closure that we're getting here. Any sort of suggestions of thinking about this? Again, it's sort of hard, but as a kind of way of ending the poem, Milton's career, this session. Yeah, Leo?
Just thinking about what was actually bothering Milton contextually, rhyme wasn't the problem. It was the rhyme being harnessed in a specific way.
Yes. Yeah.
And kind of in using rhyme while starting something new, it kind of offers rhyme as a device to, mm-hmm. to be harnessed a different mm-hmm. effect, basically.
Which is, I think, you know, one could argue, Michael, what Byron is doing, is he's taking a rhyming form and trying to use it, show that it can be used for liberation. And sort of people debated about that, whether he actually succeeds or kind of reinscribes the constraints that he thinks he's breaking away from Miranda. Yeah.
And I just wanted to mention this, it spurs a broad question for me of what constitutes not just formal closure, but
yes.
formal catharsis.
Okay.
In
yeah.
this instance, what's the distinction? What makes for a level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No
yeah. No, but and it's hard, obviously, because you haven't read the poem. But I think you know, so it does raise those questions. I think, it's, you know, I mean, in a way, it's raising the question again, to see the sort of about what the experience of the poem has done,
why and how.
Yeah, Michael.
The final pairs are quite interesting. Yeah, I like to read rhymes as like narratives.
Yes. Yes. Of course.
An extent, a quiz dismissed. You know, it's sort of as if the poem is being. Sort of set off, right, in those final threes.
Right, yeah.
As a kind of narrative, right? It's dismissed, but what precedes it is intent and event and a twist and resist, right? So I like how rhyme can sometimes tell a story.
It's still the story, as in Herbert, as in the right. Herbert example, I think there's something like that, yeah.
Some of our previous discussion, oft he seems to hide in space but when expecting you return. Does he replace he with it to refer to rhyme?
Yes. Oh, yes, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Yeah, that, you know, sort of, the rhyme has been submerged in this, and then it's erupting at the end. So I guess, I mean, it's interesting if we think about just, you know, sort of, it's a little bit like the end of Lycidas, where after, you know, sort of playing with different forms, at the end of the poem, an identifiable form, you seem to almost settle into an identifiable form. Here it's more problematic, though, because it's not a conventional sonnet. You know, sort of we perhaps might say that with the 14 lines, there's more, Milton is suggesting a more flexible kind of sonnet here. But it does, as in Lycidas, kind of suggests that, you know, sort of for reaching closure, you know, sort of he's looking to rhyme. And a rhyme, too, that very typical of Milton, you know, especially when he's writing his sonnets, is that he doesn't end with a couplet. He avoids the Shakespearean sonnet. He tends to end with, you know, something open here, you know, EF, 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 you know, sort of it's the interlocking couplets. Not quite as open as in some cases, but not knitting things together quite so tightly. It's, you know, sort of a looser weaving. My concern about the poem or wondering about this end here is that part of me wants to see it as Milton's, you know, making up to rhyme for what he did in the headnote to the verse or showing that rhyme, you know, sort of still can be used. The other possibility, though, that I think is that this is spoken by the chorus, who, as some of you will know, tends to be a little bit simplistic, as in the choruses in Greek tragedy, that the chorus represents, you know, kind of the voice of the community, who often want to say, you know, sort of platitudinous things like, all is best, though we oft doubt, you know, God works in mysterious ways, but it's always good. The role of the chorus in Greek tragedy is often to impose closure on a situation that is so wild and so out of control that it's needed. And I wonder if, you know, that's, you know, sort of what's going on here is that the chorus is getting out their heavy-duty rhyme artillery at the end of the poem to try to contain it. But also if there's a way, too, because critics have debated about whether Samson's action is redemptive or a sign of his further falling, is this a sign that, you know, Samson is further and kind of in bondage with the rhyme? Yeah, Manuel?
It seems to be a kind of fortunate fall, or it tries to impose
right.
meaning yeah. on Samson's death.
Yes.
That's something that Milton...
Yeah.
Which is against
it. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just a little, you know, sort of there is a certain kind of simplifying upbeatness in this. You know, he died, it was a good cause.
And it's lacking, you mentioned this, typical of the other poems, where it's an ending and also a new beginning.
Yes, okay. That, I think that's an important point, too, is that of all Milton's endings, this is the one with the most closure. That it relies on, you know, sort of the Aristotelian idea of catharsis, that, you know, sort of, that our passions have been spent, it's all over. And I think that is part of the troubling aspect of the end of the poem, is that in a way the completeness of the closure, the chorus trying to seal everything up tidily, is what actually makes it disturbing, because it's a poem that, and a hero that isn't so easily contained, as some of you may see in November 30.
But even seeing the chorus as this kind of social reinforcement of rhyme, it's like there is some redemptive quality in the sense mm-hmm. that it's still using rhyme to break apart the couplet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's not. It doesn't kind of conform to the couplets. It still. It gives them a bit more breathing room. There mm-hmm. is more breathing
yeah.
room.
Yeah. No, Milton. I mean, Milton very rarely does use a couplet. I mean, it appears in different forms. But so there's a sense that you know there's more of a kind of openness in this rhyme with the closure. Lena?
I was just going to say that the closure seems like reluctant, like
yeah,
like it's not naturally happening, and so it's being even more forced with having a third, like, EF.
Yes, pattern. Okay. Yeah, that's a good
yeah,
point.
Whereas
yeah,
whereas there's just ABAB's CBCD, and then six lines by Whitney.
Right,
like,
okay.
You can think of it because of the, like, 14-line sonnet thing, but then if it stems from the fact of the, like, preceding pattern of four,
mm-hmm.
it just be like, it has to be extended to be fully like hammered and like sealed off.
Oh, right. That you sort of just the extra words there is that it's having a bit of difficulty reaching the resolution, that it keeps on sort of repeating the pattern. That's an interesting thought. Yeah.
This might be slightly romantic, but it kind of goes back to what you said about the end of the hymn, in the sense that it got stuck on the rhyme, so it therefore needs another
right.
form
okay.
that begins
yeah.
right after. So it almost implies that movement, in the sense that it got stuck, and now
yeah.
a new form is needed.
And now a new yeah. But it's you know sort of I think you know sort of in a way just the ending there, although I mean I think one of the things that I suppose always I find sort of troubling is that the end seems to be so directive too about how the reader is supposed to feel at the end of the poem, you know, sort of that you're supposed to have all passion spent. So there's this the chorus is really trying to contain the experience. In a way. And I think to me that kind of emphasizes, you know, some of these other things, the fact that the experience exceeds their interpretation of it. Emily?
Yeah, I kind of feel like this is how Milton doesn't want his
yeah.
sort of career
and
his career to be read, just with the parallels between Samson and Milton's
right.
blind. But I just think that this is sort of yeah, exactly what Milton is sort of bringing
mm-hmm.
at, like this sort of
Yeah, and I mean, of course, you know, sort of Milton himself did not know that he was going to die in 16. You know, we can look back at this with significance as Milton's last work, and you know, maybe he wasn't planning anything else after this, but you know, sort of maybe he was. Well, rather than try to force and contain closure too much, I think we sort of might just end there, and then we can, you know, maybe sort of, unless anyone has any last words that they want to say. Yeah, Shandy?
I was just wondering if you're talking about Ryan, you're talking about Ryan, could you say something about the other forms of parallelisms to just in broader
right.
stuff that are there in Paradise Lost and Lycidas, not so much here,
okay.
or where certain sounds or certain words repeat
yes.
in the poem.
Yeah.
So, sometimes in the sense of alliteration or
right.
assonance, but
yeah.
other kinds of parallelism, like in Lycidas, once more, and I was just diagnosing
yeah.
it, and you were saying.
Yeah.
So other kinds of, maybe not, we can call them lines, but parallelisms.
Well, I think that's a good, you know, sort of, in, especially in Paradise Lost, because Milton isn't using rhyme, then there are other things that he has to use to hold the poem together. I mean, if you're thinking about rhyme as a principle of unification in a poem, you know, sort of giving it a certain kind of unity. And in Lycidas, it's some one way we're sort of talking about it is if, you know, sort of the rhyme itself isn't quite adequate or the rhyme is struggling to do that. So there have to be other things, and that's verbal repetition. That's really big, you know, sort of with Milton. Alliteration, he uses that in sort of different ways. But I think, you know, sort of in Paradise Lost, I mean, especially because it's just such a big work. You know, one of the, you know, sort of, there are different forms of patterning, of course. I mean, if you're with a poem, imagery is going to be a huge element of coherence. And with Milton, there are sort of keywords, too, that keep on coming back. And they often choose ones that are kind of nondescript or you know, sort of not flashy. In Paradise Lost, one of the keywords is sweet. Another one is part. And they sort of come back, and it becomes this kind of refrain that goes through it, or at least in Eden. And then, you know, sort of other characters will have the kind of keywords that come, you know, sort of that define them as well. So he can use those. So they're, you know, of course, not using rhyme, there are all kinds of poetic properties that he's got that can do the same kind of thing. And he still has the line, and he's got, you know, sort of meter, you know, that just the one thing he doesn't have is it doesn't use there is rhyme. So Thomas, yeah.
Does Satan have a keyword, or he's too loud for
that? Well, I just, you know, sort of thinking about that. I mean, there's certainly words that come back, you know, in his... you know, in his speeches a lot, you know, sort of about himself. But I'm not sure, you know, sort of, I'll think about that some more, you know. Yeah.
I just have a question in the sense of Milton, because I'm thinking about this recently, like, to what extent does the rhyme drive the content? Because that's always been how Byron works in a way.
Yeah.
Loves the rhyme, and, you know, I have to fill these lines now, yeah. Right? Rather than the content driving the rhyme.
But Byron, sometimes that's not true too.
No.
He wants to, you know, he wants when he really wants to be outrageous, he'll do that. But I think, you know, it's yeah, no, it's but it's, you know, I mean, it's, you know, one thing we didn't really get a chance to get into is, you know, sort of, but you know, what is it like to actually, you know, imagine thinking in rhyme, you know, which Pope said that he did, you know, that Byron at some time seems to do. And I think with Milton, you know, sort of, and our tendency is always to say that a good poet, you know, the rhyme does not drive the content, that the content drives the rhyme. But, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work out that way. I think with Milton, you know, sort of that the rhyme words, because he's not trying to do rhyme, you know, sort of mahogany or, you know, sort of, he doesn't try to rhyme flashy, complicated things very often. And that makes it easier for him. So he has more of a choice.
I just wanted to make one little observation. I just went to his sonnets, and he does use couplets, but only at the end of the Italian sonnets.
Only at the time.
The ones he writes in Italian, but
yeah,
never in
not
the English.
English, yeah.
So I wonder if there's for him a linguistic appropriateness, or...
I mean, it's also a kind of inversion. Yes, I mean, I think
like
sort of the couplets, you know, sort of the kind of closure in his English sonnets, they're much more Petrarchan and sort of refusing neat closure. So it's interesting, I've forgotten about the Italian sonnets. It's almost as if he used Petrarchan sonnets
in
English, and then the English, you know, sort of couplet he can use safely in Italian.
Yeah.
Any comments? Yeah. Okay.
Just, you know, the rhyme often associates words, I find, and
yeah.
It actually makes these kind of associations that might not elsewhere be there, because it's the obvious rhyme.
Yeah.
Like, how many times can death and breath rhyme?
Right.
You know, and so then poets kind of have these associations, right, but kind of in their heads already, I find, that there's some connection between death and breath. These kind of obvious rhymes that you just see over and over and over. And so I start to expect that when I see death, I'm going to see breath.
Yeah.
If I don't see death, it's like, oh, God. You know, or something, then, you know, these certain rhymes that just almost always occur, right? And so I'm interested.
Well, that's also, I mean, that potentially also suggests the reason why increasingly poets have gone away from rhyme is because of the exhaustion. I mean, people always make the comments that it's much easier to rhyme in French and Italian than in English, that the repertoire of words in English are harder. So creating new rhymes and new connections gets harder when you've got a huge repertoire, when you've had all of these writers, and when you've got, you know, sort of then, you know, again, you know, Byron, you know, sort of dredging everything, you know, finding everything that he could get to rhyme. So I think that it does make it increasingly challenging. So that's something to consider about why, you know, why people have moved away from rhyme.
Thank you.
Thank you all.